ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate, Connor, and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show lined up. As always, I want to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. We're going to start this week with an area of ETFs that typically doesn't get a whole lot of attention, which is grain and agriculture ETFs. But what's happening is, between the ongoing trade war with China and then some of the wild weather we've had in the Midwest, some of these ETFs have started taking off recently. And so investors are beginning to take notice here. If you're not familiar with grain ETFs, believe it or not, there are ETFs that allow you to invest in corn futures contracts or wheat futures, or even an index covering corn, wheat, and things like soybeans. In just a moment, we'll be joined by ETF.com's Laura Krieger to take a look at this area. We're going to discuss some of the ETF options here, how you might think about these from an investment standpoint. And then we'll also spend a few minutes considering the bigger picture, just whether rising grain prices are inflationary and whether this might continue being a concern moving forward with things like climate change. And that'll actually be a nice segue, because we'll then be joined by Jordan Ferris, head of ETF product development at Nuveen. We're going to talk socially responsible investing, ESG, which of course includes considering the environment. And I think you're going to enjoy this, because I'm going to take a bit of a different approach with Jordan. I'm going to bring up various objections I hear towards ESG. So everything from underperformance to whether or not investors really care about this, to something I've pondered, which is whether the market is already a natural ESG screening mechanism, just that companies not doing the right things will naturally see that reflected in their share prices over time. Jordan knows this space inside and out. Nuveen has really hung their hat on ESG, especially on the ETF side. So this should be an insightful conversation. We'll also touch on a new ESG ETF Nuveen launched last week. And then later, we'll also be joined by Eric Irvin, CEO of BlockForce Capital. The topic will be cryptocurrencies and blockchain. And BlockForce is an interesting company. They offer hedge funds focused on the blockchain space. They're also rolling out a cryptocurrency investment platform, sort of a robo-advisor model. And then they have an ETF business as well. It's called Reality Shares, where they offer two blockchain ETFs, and they previously filed for an ETF which would have included Bitcoin futures. So we're going to try and cover all of that with Eric. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci. Also, if you enjoy ETF Prime, we would greatly appreciate if you could leave us a quick review on Apple Podcasts. All right, let's start with ETF.com's Laura Krieger.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETF.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
Laura, so we're going to discuss an area of ETFs that probably doesn't get a whole lot of attention, which is grain and agriculture ETFs. You have an excellent piece out right now on ETF.com. It's titled Floods and Tariffs Lift Grain ETFs. I highly recommend everyone check that out. But basically, this combination of the trade war, along with the weather in my neck of the woods, all the rain we've had in the Midwest, this is having a real impact on supply and demand for things like corn and soybean and wheat. And so because of that, we've seen some related ETFs start to take off. I guess first, give us the backdrop here. How exactly is the trade war and weather impacting grains?
Sure. So really, this is a story about weather and first and foremost, right? So corn and wheat prices are surging because farmers are super behind on their plantings this year. I took a look at the USDA's most recent weekly crop progress report, which is a lot of fun to read through, a lot of fun light reading there. And farmers had planted more than half their crop after May 25th, according to that report. That is super late. For the past 25 years, less than 20% of the crop has been planted that late. So farmers are really way behind on their plantings this year, and that's because of massive rainfall and flooding we've had throughout the agricultural state, from Indiana down to Arkansas. It's just one big puddle. And
yeah.
Farmers...
Well, I was going to say, just to give people an idea, so I'm here in the Kansas City area. In May, we had the most rain in the 131 years they've tracked the data. So we had 13 inches of rain, and actually that was the third wettest month ever. And then so far in June, we've had more rain. You know, we're just not set up to handle that. So, yeah, the rain has been a real issue.
Right, exactly. And it's the story in Kansas City. It's the story in Little Rock. It's the story, you know, up in Indiana as well. It's everywhere. There are flooded rivers. There's rain-drenched fields. There's levee breaches. There's rivers that are so high that barges can't get through. The entire supply chain is struggling with weather right now, and unless something changes fast, 2019 is probably going to be one of the worst crops on record. Combine that whole flooded out picture with what's going on in the South, in states like Georgia and South Carolina, where there's extreme heat, there's drought conditions. And so that's baking these fields before the seeds can ever really germinate, and that's causing its own issues. So U.S. picture is really bad. On top of that, there's the trade war going on. So China, which is typically, historically, one of our largest, if not our largest, buyer of soybeans, they just stopped. They just flat out stopped buying our soybeans. And the reason is because of this ongoing tariff nonsense. And that is just killing farmers, especially here in my home state of Louisiana. Not only is there less crop going into the ground, but there's nobody to buy it when it comes up. So the Trump administration's having to bail out farmers to the tune of $16 billion. That's, you know, funded by tariff proceeds. But it's a bad, bad situation right now.
All right. So because of all this, corn and wheat in particular have really started taking off recently. And in your ETF.com piece, you noted five of the top 10 best performing ETFs over the past 30 days or so have been agriculture related exchange traded products. Give us a quick rundown here. What are some of the ETPs that have done well?
Yeah, actually, the top three in a row were all grains ETFs, ETNs and ETPs. So the best performer was the Element MLCX Grains Index Total Return ETN, ticker GRU. GRU, that's quite a mouthful. A lot of these have very long names here, so I apologize in advance. GRU rose 17% over the past month, and that was followed by the Tucrium Wheat Fund, which is ticker WEAT, or wheat, and that rose 16%. And then the third highest best performer was the IPATH Series B Bloomberg Grains Sub-Index Total Return ETN, ticker JJG, and that rose 14%. So GRU and JJG are both diversified grain ETNs. GRU tracks an index of the four front-month futures contracts, while JJG tracks contracts across many expiration dates. And GRU tracks soybean oil, in addition to the big three, which are corn, soy, and wheat. JJG just tracks the big three. Wheat, by the way, is just a pure play wheat fund.
Laura, you mentioned futures, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but out of the products you just listed, there are futures-based products. There are also ETNs, exchange-traded notes. Do you mind just very briefly explaining the major differences here and maybe how they compare to more plain vanilla ETFs for investors looking at this space?
Oh, sure, yeah. So the two main ways to access commodities are through the futures-based ETFs and ETNs, like you said. So futures-based ETFs, like it says on the tin, they hold commodity futures contracts, either of a single commodity or multiple ones, or a single expiration date or multiple ones. And an ETF that holds futures contracts is always going to have some cost of buying those contracts baked in. And that's going to maybe cause a little bit of drift away from the index that they're tracking. The counterpoint to that, I guess, is the ETN, which doesn't hold anything. That's just a debt instrument issued by a bank that's tied to the performance of a single index. So there shouldn't be any tracking error or minimal tracking error in ETNs because they're not buying and selling anything. But ETNs also have issuer risk, and that's, you know, the chance that the bank that issues them might default. It's rare, but it has happened in the past. It's something that you always should think about when you're talking about ETNs. The other big difference about ETFs that hold futures contracts is that they are going to issue a special kind of tax form called the K-1, which, if you're not familiar with it, can be kind of a pain in the patushka to deal with. Some broad commodity funds now are being structured so that they specifically avoid the K-1 form. But, you know, ETNs, they don't have a K-1 form. There are some tax benefits to a futures-based ETF, but those are, like, way deep in the weeds, and we're not going to I'm not going to bore your listeners.
Yeah, topic for another show. Laura, going back to performance, we should point out the strong performance that you highlighted has been more recent. A lot of these funds were actually bludgeoned prior to May. I just want to point that out because I think it highlights the nature of these products as well, right? These are probably going to be more for trading or hedging, not necessarily longer-term investing.
Exactly. Commodities, as a general rule, whether you're talking about grains or oil or whatever, it's a super volatile asset class. There's no consistent supply and demand story from year to year or even month to month. And there's no consistent supply and demand story between the various commodities even. You can't just lump soybeans in with gold and expect them to perform the same way. So these grains ETPs and really any commodity fund, they've got very complicated fundamentals, and they tend to vary in performance, like you said, on short time scales. The other thing is cost, right? You can't talk about these sorts of ETPs without talking about the cost of them because they're more expensive than maybe some investors are used to. The average expense ratio for a commodity ETP is 122 basis points. That's huge. And it actually goes even higher than that for some of the Tucrium pure play grains funds like the corn fund and wheat and so on. If you're a short-term trader, that doesn't matter to you as much because you're not going to be holding it for as long, for that annual expense ratio to, you know, eat as much of your return. But for a long-term buy and hold investor, I mean, for the love of God, don't buy an ETF that has 300 basis points expense ratio and hold it forever. You know, you're going to get killed in fees.
What about something like the Invesco DB Agriculture Fund, ticker DBA? This is more of a broad play on the space, and this is actually by far the most popular ETP in agriculture. Any thoughts on that product?
Yeah, I think that DBA is kind of an interesting fund. When you're looking at commodities ETPs, you really have to consider the cost of holding the underlying futures contracts as much as you can. DBA, it does see how I want to say this. It's a fund that thinks intelligently about something called roll cost, which is if I had to sum it up, it's the cost to maintain a constant commodity futures exposure. And it's by selling one expiring futures contract and buying another up. So roll cost is kind of an obsession with commodities investors, as well it should be, because roll costs can kind of kill your return if you end up buying high and selling low. VBA takes a smart approach to the roll strategy by spreading its exposure across a variety of expiration dates to kind of minimize these roll costs. But it also, you know, kind of goes back to what I was saying before. It has a higher expense ratio at 89 basis points. So you could use JJG, which is the ETN that I was talking about earlier, the iPath one, that has a roll strategy that is also designed, or the index, I should say, has a roll strategy designed to minimize roll costs. It's, you know, also part of these new wave of iPath ETNs that are much more investor friendly. They have a call feature, they're cheaper, and so on and so forth. So it's really up to you.
All right. I have to point out, if you want to avoid futures contracts or ETNs, there is another option, which is the VanEck Vectors Agribusiness ETF. And I point this out because this has one of my favorite ticker symbols of all time, MOO, M-O-O. But this owns the stocks of companies involved in agriculture. And if you look at performance, this thing has actually outperformed everything else we've talked about today since the beginning of the year, though it's significantly underperformed over the past month because it owns equities. Any thoughts on this one?
Absolutely. Commodity equity ETFs like MOO, just in general, they're not the same as investing in a commodity ETF. They have different returns. They have different drivers behind them. And if you think about it, it makes sense that a commodities equity fund, a fund of producers and growers, is always going to lag wherever the prices of those underlying commodities are going to go. They're always going to be a little step behind. And so in the case of MOO right now, that's a good thing, right? MOO is up 11% year to date. Compare that to DBA, which is down 2%. So yay for MOO. That's great for them. The broader stock market has a large impact on commodity equity ETFs that I think gets overlooked. So, you know, you're not just looking at what the underlying commodity the impact isn't just from the underlying commodity prices. It's also from what's happening in the stock market. And the stock market's doing, you know, not so bad right now. So I'd be willing to bet that the reason MOO is up, whereas the underlying commodity prices are down, is because, you know, they're not quite as exposed on a, how do I want to say it? It's the rise in grain prices are probably helping buoy the producers in MOO, and also the stock market is helping, just general equity upward trend, compared to DBA, which kind of spreads its exposure across these many contracts. It's all very complicated. This is all so complicated, Nate. Another reason why I don't necessarily believe that these products are always appropriate for just average retail day-to-day investors.
No, completely agree. Again, as we said previously, I think these are trading or hedging tools, or at best a small satellite position in a well-diversified portfolio. Laura, we only have about 2 minutes left. Just bigger picture here, with agricultural commodities rising recently, do you think this is sort of a longer-term inflationary signal that perhaps we should keep an eye on, or do you think it's more of a short-term blip? And look, I always say, we are not here to make market calls, but the fact is rising corn and rising wheat prices, that can show up in food prices, that can have an impact on people's pocketbooks. Do you think that's a concern at all?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's going to continue to be a concern, right? So one of the reasons I like following these ETFs is that I feel like they're a canary in a coal mine, right? They're a canary in the coal mine for inflation. They're also a canary in the coal mine for climate change, too. I mean, we can't forget, we can't set aside that the reason these grain prices are rising is because of record flooding. And we're talking flooding, like you said earlier, in Kansas City, flooding at the levels that we have never seen before. So in the short term, ag prices are going to rise, they're going to fall, whatever. But realistically, on the longer scale, we're going to see these continue to rise and rise and rise and rise. And the reason is because it's going to get harder and harder to grow things in a world that's always too wet and too hot for them to grow. So, and I know that sounds very apocalyptic and dire, but it's just realism. So these are definitely, you know, maybe not investments for everybody, but it's certainly investments that everybody should keep an eye on for the future.
Well, Laura, that's a perfect place to end because we're actually going to talk ESG in our next segment and talk about the environment. Always appreciate your time. I've got to say, your ability to cover every nook and cranny of the ETF space never ceases to amaze me. Excellent job on grains this week. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Nuveen's Jordan Ferris. We're going to talk ESG, or socially responsible investing, and we'll also look at a brand new ETF Nuveen launched last week focused on the ESG space. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Our next guest is Jordan Ferris, head of ETF product development at Nuveen. Nuveen currently offers 12 ETFs with nearly $800 million invested, including a new ETF they just launched last week, the Nuveen ESG Large Cap ETF, which fits right into their existing ESG ETF lineup. ESG stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. This is also referred to as socially responsible investing, sustainable investing. And I would say Nuveen has really hung their hat on ESG, which is what we'll be discussing today. Jordan is on the line with us from Chicago. Jordan, thanks for joining us this week.
Great to be here today. Thanks for having me on, Nate.
So, Jordan, I thought I might try something a little bit different this week. We've actually covered this topic of ESG several times in the past. And so I thought it might be interesting for me to play devil's advocate here, because I think this might actually help paint the case for ESG investing. And so as I think through some of the reasons I've heard on why investors may not be interested in ESG, there are three in particular that come to mind. And I want to lay these out for you. So number one, concerns about performance, right? Just that maybe investors are sacrificing something here. Mm-hmm. Number two, there's no one-size-fits-all approach. In other words, one investor might care more about the environment, another might care more about gender diversity, or even a single investor might have a hard time reconciling investing in a company that does really well in the environment, but maybe they have a poor track record on diversity. And then number three, I just wonder if in today's day and age, people simply expect companies to do the right things. And if they don't, people will boycott them, they'll protest them, beat them up on social media. I guess the point being that maybe people feel like those things will move the needle more than whether they own a small number of a company's shares in their IRA or whatever. So, look, I know there's a lot there, especially right off the bat, and maybe we can take this in pieces. But do one of those reasons stand out to you? Do you just disagree with all of them? I guess I'll let you pick where to begin.
So I think I can address all three of those. So why don't we kind of go in order as how you laid those out. So performance, and I can handle that objection. The sort of no one size fits all, and how people will take their own values and apply that to their investments and how they're reconciling that. And then I'll talk a little bit about, you know, how individuals are interacting with companies on an individual basis, whether it be protesting, you know, in person or doing so online, or just making purchasing decisions with, you know, what they're going to be buying for themselves. So we'll take a look at all three of these things. Let's start up top with the number one objection or myth that we see coming from environmental, social, and governance type products, and that is the performance myth. Far and away, when I'm speaking with advisors and investors, the number one objection that comes up is, I don't want my investments to underperform, and I assume if you are doing an ESG type overlay, an environmental, social, and governance overlay, the investments are going to underperform. And it's no longer the case, but it is, it has been something that's been ingrained in a lot of our minds for a number of years. The reason is 20 or 30 years ago, when a lot of these types of products came to market, they were actually called socially responsible investments, or SRI. When they came to market, the approach that was being used was an exclusionary-based approach, meaning that asset managers would simply pick out the areas of the market that made us feel bad, and they would exclude those from the portfolio. So you can think about things like tobacco companies or casinos or controversial weapons manufacturing, things like that. They would exclude them from the portfolio, and you were left with whatever was left over. This created some performance deviations because what it did was throw off all of the sector exposures that you had underlying that investment. So things were driving performance that weren't really related to an individual investor's personal values. If you fast forward to today, or you know, 5 or 10 years ago, we start having the rise of what's called ESG data. So all of these data points that various ESG data vendors are putting together so we can compare companies against each other. And now, instead of simply excluding companies from our portfolios based on an industry that they operate in, what we can do now is rank companies within the same industry. So I can rank healthcare companies against healthcare companies. I can rank consumer discretionary companies against other consumer discretionary companies, and I can pick the ones that are doing the best managing their environmental, social, and governance risks, and I can invest in those. So you get a higher ESG score as opposed to just avoiding sectors that don't make us feel good. We still do incorporate that as a part of our methodology, but far and away, what's deciding what securities go in our portfolios now is those that are leading from an ESG perspective. What that allows us to do is have a broadly diversified portfolio across all sectors for international products, across all countries, and deliver the risk and return characteristics that people have come to expect from non-ESG products. So that performance myth has shifted in that it doesn't exist anymore based on today's strategies.
Okay, so that's a perfect transition into the no one-size-fits-all approach concern, because if you're not necessarily excluding certain companies, you may run into this issue, or an investor may run into this issue where they're having a hard time reconciling a company who maybe does really well on one thing but not so well on the other thing, but overall they're doing well enough to be included in an ESG product. How do you think about that?
Sure. So I think about that in terms of a balance. You need to balance the level of ESG improvement and for our products in particular, the carbon footprint reduction, and balance that with still delivering the risk and return profile that you want. So with our strategies, we still do exclude those companies that are in controversial business areas, such as nuclear power, such as controversial weapons manufacturing, tobacco, alcohol, gambling, things like that. But in practice, a lot of those companies actually have relatively low ESG scores anyways, and they wouldn't make it through our screens. So when we're thinking about no one size fits all, what we're striving to do is improve the ESG, we'll call it the ESG-ness, of our strategies and reduce the carbon footprint. So we are investing in companies that do have better diversification policies or support gender diversification at their firm, at the board level and the C-level, support equal pay for all people doing the same job, have good safety procedures in place, manage their environmental footprint well. These are all things that are good for a company's business model, and those are companies that we're looking to include in our product. So it is an improvement story. Now, there are a number of investors who have a specific passion about one thing or another, and that's going to vary investor to investor. So I like to think of this as there are three ways that you can sort of affect change. You can do it by donating money, by giving to charity. You can do it by protesting, or you can do it by investing, or you can do all three. The investment, if you want to maintain diversification and you want to have exposure to large cap, mid cap, small cap, core fixed income, things like that, there is a balance between how much increase in ESG you have and what the risk return profile you're going to get is going to be. If you have something that you're very passionate about, maybe it makes more sense to give to a charity in that area or go protest or direct your buying decisions. But for investments, it may make sense to balance those two things. What do I want in terms of ESG improvement? What do I want in terms of my risk-return profile?
Yeah, and I guess that addresses the third point that I raised. You mentioned the ESG data. Can you talk more about how Nuveen compiles ESG data and metrics? What does that process look like? And I guess more importantly, are there any concerns regarding data integrity just because of self-reporting by companies?
So we at Nuveen, we bring in a variety of different data sources. We use a variety of different ESG data vendors across our entire firm. Our parent company, TIAA, has actually been in this space for about 50 years. We have a team at Nuveen of 25-plus individuals that work on our responsible investing team. So we have a lot of experience. We dedicate a lot of resources to this space. That team evaluates and essentially performs due diligence on a fairly high number of ESG data vendors on an annual basis. So we understand where the data is coming from, how those data vendors are compiling that data, and review their procedures and policies to make sure that it is of the highest quality. Specific to the ETFs, we use one data vendor. We use MSCI. We chose them because they have very high quality data relative to the other competitors in the space. They have one of the broadest sets of data as well. When we were looking to get into this space, one of the items that kept coming up was there are all of these acronyms that are in the space, ESG, SRI, RI, impact investing, sustainability. And there was a lot of confusion about all of the jargon that's going around. So we wanted to use one data set with one methodology within our product set so it eases how people can get to a full understanding of what we're doing with our product. Now, there are some of the data that is reported, some companies are doing some self-reporting, but MSCI has a rules-based methodology for uncovering all of this data. They use NGO data sets, they use annual reports, they use company disclosures, and they use the Carbon Disclosure Project, in addition to many other sources. If they cannot get enough data on a company to actually give them an ESG score or determine what their carbon footprint is going to be, they simply don't rate that company, and that company becomes ineligible for inclusion in our products. So there has to be data available for a company to be included in our products, which I think helps to solve for some of that data issue.
Jordan, going back to me playing devil's advocate here, and as you talk about the data and metrics, one of the arguments I've made before is that the financial markets and not ESG committees or rating agencies, the financial markets will ultimately decide which companies are quote unquote doing the right things. In other words, over time, if companies aren't conducting business according to whatever society standards are in the aggregate, won't they ultimately see that reflected in their stock prices and you know, ultimately fade away? Isn't there some natural selection here?
There's probably some natural selection for that, but a lot of the factors that companies are graded upon, the key performance indicators or the KPIs, which is another acronym people may hear, are non-balance sheet items. They're not going to be found on the income statement. They're not going to be found on the cash flow statement or on the balance sheet. So these are other data points that portfolio managers can use in their investment selection process and when they're analyzing a company to see, do we think this company is doing things that will sustain them for the long term. So I think there probably is a little bit of truth to the fact that the market will naturally screen these companies out, but it doesn't exist anywhere in the balance sheet right now. So this is an additional data point that PMs can use in their evaluation.
All right, enough devil's advocate for me. Let's talk about the growth in this space. And I saw a research note from CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth last week where he said ESG stock ETF assets have grown 63% since the end of 2017, which is actually significantly more than the 17% growth for smart beta ETFs, which of course always seem to get a lot of attention. Now, that is off of a smaller asset base, but what do you think is driving this?
So I think there are a few things that are driving this. Every year, Nuveen conducts what we call our responsible investing survey. We just completed the fourth, released the results of our fourth responsible investing survey recently, and we're showing that there is continues to be growing interest in this space, not only investing in this space, but learning more about this space. And we find that the investors that are learning more about the space tend to invest in the space eventually. So two groups in particular that have very high levels of interest in investment are millennials and women, which together control significantly more than 50% of the wealth in the country right now. So you have these two groups of people that are pushing into this space. That's driving some of the growth. The other item that I think is starting to drive the growth is you are seeing advisors become more educated in this space. They realize that as millennials are becoming a bigger and bigger percentage of their client base, they need to have an ESG offering. Whether they agree with it or not, they need to have this within their stable as something that they can offer up to their clients. And if they're going to be offering it up, they need to learn about this space and understand the products that are out there. They need to understand what ESG means and how to understand the different products that label themselves as ESG, because there are different methodologies underlying those products. In the survey, this year, advisors are becoming more proactive with discussing ESG with clients. 51% of advisors this year, or from 2018, from this year's survey, said they do discuss it with clients on a regular basis. That's compared to 41% the year before. So just one year, year over year, you see a 10% rise in the number of advisors who are actively discussing ESG with their clients. And I think that is driving a lot of investment as well.
Interestingly, the two biggest ETF launches so far this year are both ESG ETFs. And I think what's noteworthy here is both of these were seeded by a large pension insurance company. Do you think that could be a good model moving forward to really help ESG catch on in the mainstream, just have larger institutional investors sort of lead the way, and then perhaps smaller investors might follow?
I think absolutely. I mean, we tend to think of the institutional investors as the very sophisticated investors. So if they are comfortable putting significant amounts of money into ESG-type products, they must have found that over the long term, this does something, whether it enhances performance or helps them manage risk in a better way using ESG as a risk management tool, then that eventually will come down to the retail client and say these strategies not only are they only available to institutions, they're now available to retail clients as well.
All right, Jordan, we have just a few minutes left. Let's briefly talk about Nuveen's ESG ETF lineup. There are now 9 ESG ETFs in all. You just launched the Nuveen ESG Large Cap ETF last week, ticker symbol NULC. You also offer one of the few ESG bond ETFs, the Nuveen ESG US Aggregate Bond ETF, ticker NUBD. Just high level, tell us about the lineup and perhaps what makes it unique compared to some of the competing options out there.
Sure. So when we started to think about launching this suite 3 years ago, we were surveying the investment landscape, and we realized that there were two gaps that we wanted to fill. Number one, the majority of products that were in the space were very narrowly focused. So they were focused on something like maybe solar energy or clean tech or clean water, something like that. We wanted investors to be able to invest with their personal values, but still receive the risk and return characteristics that they'd get from a general asset allocation. So there weren't a lot of broad tools that people would be able to use to put together a complete asset allocation. The other item that we wanted to solve for was, even within suites of products that did exist, the methodology was different from product to product, meaning how ESG factors were applied and implemented in that strategy was different from product to product, which can cause some confusion. This is a new space for a lot of investors. We want it to be easy for them to understand the methodology that we have, and we want it to be easy for them to implement in their own portfolio. So we wanted to solve for those issues. And if you look across the 9 products we have, you'll see that they hit the big Morningstar categories. So large cap blend, large value, large growth, down to small cap blend, international, developed markets, emerging markets, core fixed income, and a couple products in the mid-cap space as well. Really the building blocks of what we would think of as the tools for putting together a complete portfolio. We also applied ESG factors in a consistent way across the entire portfolio. So if you understand the methodology for a small cap ETF, then you understand the methodology for our large cap value ETF. The other item that separates our suite apart from competing products is the deliberate inclusion of a set of low carbon criteria. And this is where, working with our responsible investment team, again, we've been in this space for about 50 years at TIAA, our parent company, while working with that team really helped us out. They pointed out to us that simply because a company has a high ESG score doesn't necessarily mean they have a low carbon footprint. And we know clients, when they hear ESG, they think low carbon. It's not always necessarily the case. So what we did was incorporate a distinct set of low carbon criteria within our methodology, which in addition to raising the ESG score, significantly reduces the carbon footprint. We think that aligns better with client values than some of the other products that are in market right now.
Jordan, as the space continues evolving and we see more ESG ETFs coming to market, any tips you might offer to investors on just sorting through the field?
So I think doing due diligence on the product methodology is very important. It's becoming more important as more products come out. So just because a product is branded ESG doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as another product that's branded ESG. So take a look at the methodology, take a look at the carbon footprint, understand what the clients want and what they think ESG actually means, because if I ask 10 people to define ESG for me right now, it's probably 10 different definitions, whereas if I ask them to define low carbon, it's probably going to be the same definition. So understand what the clients want, understand what the methodology is, and if that's delivering upon their expectations. And there are a variety of websites out there that will provide ESG scores, low carbon data, so you can compare products side by side.
Well, Jordan, really enjoyed the conversation. ESG is certainly an area that's going to continue getting more attention. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me on, Nate. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That was Jordan Ferris, head of ETF product development at Nuveen. And you can learn more about their ESG ETF lineup by visiting nuveen.com. When we come back from break, we're going to switch gears and talk blockchain and cryptocurrencies. We'll be joined by Eric Irvin, CEO of BlockForce Capital. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. I'm now very pleased to be joined by Eric Irvin, CEO of BlockForce Capital. They offer a couple of hedge funds investing in the blockchain ecosystem and cryptocurrencies. They're also in the process of rolling out a cryptocurrency investment platform called OnRamp. And BlockForce has an ETF business as well. It's called Reality Shares. They offer 7 ETFs, including 2 blockchain ETFs. Eric is on the line with us from sunny San Diego. Eric, always enjoy having you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Eric, if you don't mind, I actually want to start with OnRamp. This has me highly intrigued. So is this like a crypto robo-advisor platform?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to think about it. The problem that I was really trying to solve was even just my own problem. When I first started to learn about blockchain and cryptocurrencies as a former financial advisor, the idea was, well, I wouldn't mind having a small allocation there, but I certainly don't want to have to worry about, diversification. And I'd like to be able to simply just easy access to a tiny allocation, dollar cost average, especially into a volatile asset. And there really wasn't any solution out there, period. Now, since that time, there's been a couple, like, because the only way you could get access to the cryptocurrency market was either to open an account at an exchange, and there's some reputable ones here in the U.S., or if you wanted a diversified portfolio, then you'd have to open up accounts in Malta and all these other crazy, crazy companies. And I just wanted to create a nice, simple, easy way for people to get into the slow lane, and that's that on-ramp concept. No public and private keys, not having to worry about any of that, and really integrate all the different exchanges into one place and then offer one single place to access a portfolio of crypto assets. That was really the problem we were trying to solve.
So do you basically set up an account here, and then is there a model portfolio of cryptos? Do you select your own cryptos?
Yeah, so in the and the product hasn't launched yet. We've built it, and now we're kind of in this early stages of starting to test it out with different, you know, small group of beta testers. But that's exactly the premise, is it's a market cap weighted portfolio. So, you know, the largest crypto assets on down to some of the smaller ones. Presently, there's about 8 different crypto assets on there. And then over time, we'll be expanding it to 18. And then eventually, hopefully, all of them. And then the default portfolio would be kind of a cap weighted market portfolio of the top 6. And then you could add other assets to it as you wish. You can. It has the spare change function where, you know, every time you swipe your credit card, it'll round up to the nearest dollar and then keep the change. And a little bit like Acorns, but now into crypto assets. And then the second iteration will have actual model portfolios that our hedge fund group will build, like a token rotation strategy, some momentum-based strategies, so people can get a little bit more active. Because in this asset class, you know, things move 5% in a minute. And so the more you can rebalance the portfolio, you actually end up, you know, you obviously create a bunch of taxes, but you end up outperforming for the most part just because you're capturing a little bit of that inefficiency in the market.
Do you have a target launch date for
Onramp? So we have, right now what we're trying to explore is, do we want to offer this direct to advisors or direct to consumers? What we've built is a direct-to-consumer app for iOS and Android, and then the second like layer is going to be a advisor-led solution. So financial advisors can refer their clients to it, and then we'll have an integration step in between. That's really what we're exploring right now. Is there enough demand on the advisor side, or do we want to go direct-to-consumer and offer that? And so likely it would be in the second half of this year.
Okay.
Full outright launch.
Now, I mentioned you also offer two funds making investments in the blockchain and crypto space. And I should point out these are for accredited investors only. But I'm curious, what are these funds designed to do?
Yeah, well, the first fund was we launched back last year, and that was a private SPV. It was basically an opportunity to invest in a very highly coveted transaction in a private sale of the future tokens, which will hopefully be issued later this year, of a project called Telegram. Telegram is a messaging app like WhatsApp or WeChat and some of those. Telegram has actually grown tremendous. Like it's over 200 million users worldwide, and they're integrating into their app, just like Facebook is trying to do, a token-based system to where you can have kind of machine-to-machine payments. You can have a whole ecosystem without having to deal with cross-border payments and remittance fees and all of that. So that's what they're building. That was that first fund. We invested in that. We were like one of 80 investors that got to participate. So it was like Kleiner Perkins, Sequoia, all the big names, and then little old us, which is a neat opportunity. And then the second fund is a systematic strategy. So it's what we basically wanted to do was to design a fund that could deliver about 80% of the upside of being in the market, crypto market, and 40% of the downside with about half of the volatility, something that just had a little bit less stomach acid than a straight outright long position in Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies. And then that's trading. It's about 60% of the portfolio is trading in systematic strategies of the largest cryptocurrencies, so trend-following systems based on the algorithms that were developed by two of our PhD quant astrophysics, you know, rocket scientists, literally. And then another team from our hedge fund group, which is really more on the capital market side. And then 40% of the fund is in market-neutral type strategies. So this would be like exchange arbitrage, where you're buying Bitcoin on one exchange and selling it at the same time for a higher price on a different exchange, things like that, things that are a little bit more market neutral, just capturing the inefficiencies. And that's kind of how that fund is designed.
Eric, you mentioned PhDs and astrophysicists, and you and I have talked several times in the past. I know the type of team that you're building out there at BlockForce, just the intellectual horsepower that you have behind the scenes. And just follow me here for a minute. You know, as I look at the crypto space overall, there's still clearly a lot of skepticism and naysayers around crypto assets. Maybe not so much blockchain, but definitely on the crypto side. And look, nobody knows how this is all going to play out longer term, right? Who knows if Bitcoin will be the winner or some other crypto. But as I look at the amount of talent in this space, just really smart people dedicated to building out this ecosystem, I look at all the innovation occurring, the large institutional players getting involved, right? Fidelity, Goldman, those sorts of names. It just seems insane to me to dismiss cryptos altogether. Why do you think there is still so much skepticism out there?
You know, it's so funny because it's clear to you and I, it's just an education in the beginning. Like there's that instant gut reaction or that knee-jerk reaction just to assume something is scammy just because it's different. And we had the exact same reaction with the internet in the early days. We had, you know, people saying there's no way anyone will ever put their credit card into the internet and just send it off into the ether. And then, you know, we saw more and more traditional people going into the internet space and more financial people, like people were quitting at and dropping out of school in order to start companies. And that's kind of like what we're seeing today is like there's still certain early adopters are starting to see the light and the potential of this to literally disrupt every industry. That, I mean, it's just so all-consuming, just like the internet was in the early days. And that's where you just can't dismiss it. And as an advisor, to say no is one thing, but to say no, I'm not even going to look at it, that's just almost like malpractice.
Completely agree.
It's something you have to explore and then decide, as opposed to just assuming it's fraud and scammy. And there's plenty of frauds and scams in the space, but there's frauds and scams everywhere. So you have to explore it.
All right, Eric, I apologize. We're running just a bit short on time today. I do want to make sure to ask you about the two blockchain ETFs that RealityShares offers, the RealityShares NASDAQ Next Gen Economy ETF, ticker symbol BLCN, and the RealityShares NASDAQ Next Gen Economy China ETF, ticker BCNA. Can you just give us a quick overview on both of those ETFs, what they do?
Yep. The whole premise is these are the guys building the picks and the shovels and all the infrastructure and using blockchain in their businesses. Publicly traded companies around the globe, some of the biggest, best companies, SAP, Oracle, Accenture, Microsoft, all these companies are actually using and implementing blockchain solutions. So this is like if you don't want to go all the way into the deep end with cryptocurrencies, then you can play in the shallow end with BLCN and BCNA and get access to the companies that are going to innovate in this space and capture some of that wind at your back. You're not going to be all in, but you're going to be in a much safer, tidier vehicle than going out and just opening up a cryptocurrency account.
You mentioned these as being a pick and axe play on cryptos. I know every time we have you on ETF Prime, I always ask you about a Bitcoin ETF. But as it turns out, earlier this year, RealityShares filed for the BlockForce Global Currency Strategy ETF, which would have included Bitcoin futures. Now, the SEC asked you to withdraw that filing, which you did. Are you able to speak to that at all, or can you at least give us your impression of how the SEC is handling the Bitcoin ETF process and where you think things currently stand?
Sure. Yeah, and this is, everything's in flux, but generally when a seasoned ETF issuer files a filing, it will go effective automatically on the 75th day. So we had spoken with the SEC ahead of time and let them know we wanted to file this. And they, of course, said, well, we can't look at it until you file it, but we're going to almost immediately ask you to pull it so we can talk with you a little bit more. And they are absolutely engaged. They're doing, you know, the best job that they can, which is to allow innovation, but at the same time to prevent, you know, some big blow-up or some big problem that individual investors, because that's the thing about an ETF is anyone can buy it. So they need to make sure that it's properly disclosed and that really it's not going to become a big problem. Our system was to develop something that only had a 15% allocation to Bitcoin, and not just to Bitcoin directly, but to Bitcoin futures, which are traded on regulated commodity CFTC regulated exchanges. So we felt like it was almost an olive branch to the SEC to say, you know, see, we approved something that has Bitcoin. It's pro-innovation, but at the end of the day, even if Bitcoin went to zero, then the fund would be down 15%, and that's like a bad month in the equity markets potentially, right? So that's and that's actually how people should buy cryptocurrencies anyways, as part of a diversified portfolio strategy. So that's really what we're going for. Fingers crossed. Hopefully we'll be able to continue to engage with them and get that filing approved this year, but we'll see.
Real quick, so I popped a Twitter poll out last week on when a Bitcoin ETF would be approved. So this year, 2020, 2021, or never. And I was surprised to see that a third of the respondents said never. Prediction from you on when you think a Bitcoin ETF might be approved?
I think it could actually be this year, but I'd go lower probability on that. And then For sure, next year. I'd say almost 100% probability. I think never is just not going to happen. I think that the Jay Clayton, you know, he wanted to get his work done. He's gotten a lot of the work that he wanted to get done. He's probably going to move on, and then a new chairman's going to come in, and that will kind of enable a lot more innovation to happen right there at that SEC level.
Well, Eric, we're going to have to leave it there. Always appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you.
That was Eric Urban, CEO of BlockForce Capital. That'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci. Next week, Toby Carlisle, principal at Acquirers Funds, will discuss his brand new deep value stock ETF. And then Dom Catrimbone, CEO of Whitford Asset Management, will spotlight the VolShares Large Cap ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.